It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Miss Saigon is a Broadway hit set during the Vietnam War. A Wisconsin performance is generating some controversy over the musical's portrayals of Asians. We'll hear more coming up. First, there are a lot of ideas that businesses and other workplaces take for granted. Things like feedback from supervisors makes a big difference in workplace performance, or work plans with measurable goals are the best way to be productive. But our next guest says those assumptions and many more are just plain wrong. He says that instead of relying on top-down practices, managers should focus on the unique strengths of their employees, be transparent, and realize that success doesn't look the same for every person. Ashley Goodall is the Senior Vice President of Leadership and Team Intelligence at Cisco. He's the co-author of the new book, 9 Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. That's out today. Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
We'll get into some of these 9 lies in just a minute, but big picture, you and your co-authors say there are so many things that the business world takes for granted without really challenging or examining those ideas. Why is that?
Well, the funny thing is that a lot of the things we write about in the book start off as a small good thing. So you mentioned goals, for example, and we all have this sense that if we set a goal for ourselves, that feels like a useful thing. But then very often what happens at work is we turn these small good things into big bad things by turning them into systems, if you like. And so when you take, to keep going with our example, when you take a goal which you or I set for ourselves to manifest, if you like, what's valuable to us and what we want to personally achieve, but then you turn that into a big system where goals cascade down from the top of the organization, and we're told to write our goals in alignment with the goals of the person above us, and we're told that a goal must look like this, all of a sudden they stop being ours, and they stop being useful for us as an expression of what we want to achieve.
And what does this do for workers? You're worried that people are disengaged from their jobs and ultimately, despite the best intentions of all these things, less productive. What's going on there?
Well, and I think the evidence is pretty strong, Rob, that levels of global engagement haven't changed very much in the last 20 years or so, and maybe even further back than that. And I think that we're sort of getting to a point where we've exhausted many of what has been the set of standard practices in the workplace for maybe as far back as 100 years. And I think we're at a point where people are working ever more hours. Work seems to intrude on more of our lives, if you like, than ever before. But yet at the same time, work is a more anonymous place for many of us. We don't feel seen. We don't feel understood for what is special about each of us. We don't feel that our unique contributions are called on nearly enough. And I think what we're really seeing, if you like, is a crisis in individuality in the workplace. And our workplaces, as a generalization, aren't necessarily doing enough to unlock the beautiful magic that each of us can offer.
One common theme as you go through the 9 lies in the book seems to be that there's a lot of attention paid toward fixing our weaknesses as workers or leaders to make us better. You want to see us change that. You want to see us look more at our strengths and build on those. Why is that an important change?
It's a funny one. You're right. It does run through many of the areas of the book that we sort of have a tendency when we run into something that's not working, to say, well, let's find the process step that isn't right, or let's find the shortcoming and we'll fix it. But in doing so, we sort of treat people as though people are toasters, and people aren't toasters. When toasters break, you fix them. People don't work like that. People grow the most when you figure out what's working for them and how to build on that. And that's not just sort of optimistic thinking. There's actually a lot of science behind that. When you look at how the brain works, you find that brains grow by building more synaptic connections where they already have synaptic connections. We go through life becoming, if you like, more specialized, or put differently, more distinctly us. And so the way to help somebody grow is to help them understand where they are at their most powerful and how to contribute that more fully in the world that they live in. And that's very counter to the sort of toaster thinking, if you like, that we characterize in the book.
Talking to Ashley Goodall, co-author of the new book, Nine Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. Well, I promised people some lies. Let's get into some of them. Ashley, lie number one in the book, people care which company they work for. Talk about that mindset.
Well, that's one of the lies. You look at it, and I think many people would look at that and go, well, hang on a second. I do care very much which company I work for, or at least I feel that I do. This is one where the evidence and the science is our guide. If you look at the choices that people make, if you look at whether people choose to stay at a given place or go someplace else, the company as a whole doesn't appear to make much of a difference in that, at least certainly compared to the team that somebody is on. So the truth is actually that people care which team they're on. And if you measure the local team experience at work and then look at what results from the quality of that experience, you find out when the team experience is great, productivity is great, innovation is great, creativity is great, collaboration is great. You find out that when that experience on the local team is not very good, none of the above happens, but also people walk out the door much more frequently. The stat at Cisco is that if I move you from one of our highest performing teams in the top half of team engagement to the bottom half, your chance of voluntarily leaving Cisco goes up by about 45%.
And that's a finding you had. There are different survey questions you run by workers, and there's more variation about worker satisfaction and that connection you're talking about within a company than there is between companies. So that company A's culture, company B's culture, doesn't matter. It's what I experience with this group I'm working with.
Exactly. Or put differently, the local experience always seems to trump the global experience of the company. I mean, we do talk a lot about company culture. To a certain extent, that's a sort of abstract idea or certainly an aspirational idea. We want our company to be about these things. We want our company to feel like this. But actually, the experience of a company every day is very, very ground level for all the people in it. And what that means is the experience of the company is the experience of a team. And again, when you go inside a company and you measure very carefully the elements of the local team experience that lead to productivity, creativity, innovation, and so on, you find out that those vary enormously inside a given company. So in fact, where our experience is variable is the local. It's the team experience, not the company culture overall.
So if I'm a manager of a small team, say at a corporation or a business, and I'm not, but if I were, how would I put this into practice? How would I make sure at least my team has these qualities?
Yeah, we include 8 questions in the book that are the best way we've ever found to measure the local team experience. And the first thing to do is to ask, if you're a manager, ask people on your team, are you playing to your strengths every day? That's one of the questions. Are you clear on expectations? Do you feel that your teammates have your back? Those are conversations that you can have, and they're marvelous conversations to have with an entire team. Do we feel that we have one another's back in this team? What would that feel like? What does it feel like when it doesn't work? Are the moments when it's been great, are the moments when it's let people down? What's really interesting is that if you use the team experience as, if you like, a yardstick of your particular team right now, then it leads to a great conversation. And the conversation is where all the beauty is, because each team is different. Each team needs to define its own rituals and habits and rhythms. But it's only by having a conversation about that deliberately that you get to build a great team.
Ashley Goodall is with us, Senior Vice President of Leadership and Team Intelligence at Cisco. He's co-author of the new book, 9 Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think your workplace could change to make your job more engaging or rewarding? If you are a manager of some sort, what do you think about what you're hearing from our guest? Do you do some of the things he's talking about? Have you had these kind of conversations with people you work with? And in general, think about a job you have or have had. What makes it a good job or a bad job? Is it the overall company or organization? Is it your manager? Is it the team you work with and that local culture? Let us know what you think. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Ashley Goodall, co-author of the book Nine Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. That's out today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there assumptions at your workplace about how best to manage people, train people, evaluate people that work at your workplace or that you think are just kind of jumping through hoops, don't help out at all? What makes a positive workplace, a positive work experience for you? If you've been a manager or are a manager or leader of some sort, what kind of insights have you gotten over the years? What works for you? What does not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls. Eric is with us in Cincinnati. Eric, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Eric?
Well, I am a teacher, and I recently, my last school year, I worked in one PLC, a group of teachers, and I changed schools just because I didn't feel that community was there. So I think that first lie you were talking about really rings true for me. But I was wondering if your guest had any other insights into how some of these lies might apply in schools or how they might be different.
Eric, thanks. Thanks for the call. Ashley, that's interesting because there seems to be a movement toward trying to find ways to quantitatively rate teachers more and more to evaluate their performance. Any thoughts for Eric?
Thanks for the question, Eric. The place my mind went when I heard your question was actually this question of feedback, which we also get into in the book. And as we said earlier on in the conversation, we have a sort of instinct to give people feedback on their shortcomings and say, here's how you fix it. But if you look at how the brain grows, what the brain finds most helpful is actually you're saying, not here's my judgment of you, but here's my reaction to you, and here's what worked most powerfully. I think there's a lot of interesting, there's an interesting idea there for schools where typically we're telling our kids how they fail to measure up. If our kids come home with an A, a C, and an F, we tend to pay most attention to the F and then to the C. And if there's any time left after supper, then we'll say good job for the A. But interestingly enough, the A is where somebody is going to build a life, if you like. The A is a sign of interest, the sign of a spark, the sign of something that could grow and blossom. So I think we might in our schools think a little bit more about A isn't the end of a conversation with a student. A is the beginning of a conversation.
Eric, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. But Ashley, what I wonder about is whether we're talking about the student with the A and the F or the employee who does something really well but has something they're doing pretty bad. If we focus on that strength, on that good stuff, does that spill over? Does that cascade over to help elevate that weak point too?
Well, so I think, this is a question that we have to wrestle with. When something goes wrong, of course, a manager's got to step in and say, all right, that wasn't the outcome we were looking for. Then we have to be careful. If the thing that went wrong has a set of facts that somebody missed a fact, they didn't know something, or there's a step in a process and they missed a step, then by all means, we can say with all transparency, you got your facts wrong or you missed a step. But beyond that, we finish up saying to people in our attempts to help, basically what boils down to, you need to do it my way, or you should learn from doing it my way. And people don't learn like that. So what we want to be able to say is just to shift the language a little, particularly when things don't go as planned, and say, look, the outcome we were after was this. Were we clear on the outcome? Now then, what's your best path to that outcome? How could you get there more effectively in the future? And rather than telling people the means to a goal, we need to be super clear on what the goal is. What outcome are we all after? But then have, again, a conversation about what's your best path there, given who you are, what you know, and what you bring to the table.
Ashley, as I read through your book and listen to you, I imagine there must have been conversations at some point where you're telling people in corporate leadership somewhere about your findings, and they're saying, this all sounds touchy-feely. We need quantifiable, measurable stuff. We're a serious business. Is that pushback you get?
It certainly has been said that. some of this stuff sounds, as you put it, touchy-feely. What's funny is that there is not a single touchy-feely finding in here. These are findings, if you like. These are research findings, mm-hmm. not philosophies. This is not me saying, I wish the world were a happy place and honeybees and so on and so forth. This is what happens when you look at the evidence. If you look at how brains grow, they grow best when we ask them to dream and imagine what could be, not when we tell them what's wrong. When you look at what makes for a great team, it's everybody playing to their strengths frequently. That's the finding that you come across there. When you look at what makes for excellent performers, you find that people, the best people aren't well-rounded. Indeed, the best people are spiky. They've figured out their own uniqueness and how to make that work for them ever harder. It's funny. I suppose we should be in some way celebrating the fact that something that feels like an encouraging message is actually a message delivered to us from looking very hard at the real world and how you might quantify it. Maybe we're not quite there yet, but maybe we'll get there soon.
Talking to Ashley Goodall, co-author of the new book, 9 Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. I want to look at another of the lies. I really am interested in this one. Leadership is a thing, is the lie. And I think we've all maybe experienced that idea that somebody has leadership or they don't, or they have leadership at a certain quantity. It's almost like this magical substance that makes a good leader. What do you find when you start to look at leadership?
Well, so what we do, because we think that leadership is a thing, is we try and make lists of the qualities that a leader has or should have. So we talk about, strategic ability or execution, empathy or oratory even. And we like to come up with these long lists of things and go, you know what? Leadership, the thing called leadership is to have these things on the list, because we've looked at a lot of leaders in the world and this is some of the stuff they seem to have generally in common, sort of, kinda. And that's where the problem starts, because then you go, well, instead of talking about an abstract, generic list of things, look at a real leader in the world, and do they have all the things on the list? And you find out that they never have all the things on the list. We give lots of examples in the book. If you want to talk about, let's pick on George Patton, famous general in the Second World War, who actually hit some of his soldiers who had PTSD. And you say, well, if Patton's either not a leader, which is clearly not true, or empathy isn't part of leadership, or compassion isn't part of leadership. You look at someone like JFK, we talk a lot about authenticity as part of leadership. You look at JFK and you say, well, he was keeping his illnesses hidden. So how is that authenticity? And as soon as you hold the lists of leadershipy things up to actual leaders in the real world, you find out that all the things on the list seem to be optional, which means what actually is there at all? To get to the truth, you say, well, leadership isn't actually about the leader. It's about the followers. The thing that all leaders have in common by definition is that they have followers. And if you can understand what it is that makes me follow someone else, what is it that makes me give my breath to another, if you like, then you're onto something. And as it turns out, it's less a list of abstract qualities than it is a person who has figured out how to be their most vivid selves in the world, how to be really, really clear about what they stand for. And that seems to be what people hook onto.
In our last couple minutes, if somebody's out there listening and they're thinking, wow, I want to start applying these ideas to my team, whether that's a big business, a nonprofit, a school, what have you, what are some ways that they can get started in making this mindset shift?
So from all the research that we've done, the best leaders seem to be able to do two things. Best team leaders. They seem to be able to see each individual person on a team or in a school, if you like, for who they are. They're really, really good at making each individual seen and understanding how to put the best of what that individual has to offer in the service of the team, if you like. So leaders are great individualizers of the now. And then the other thing that the best team leaders seem to be able to do is to make the future universal. Here's where we all can go. Here's what we can all step into. So there's a kind of a present tense. I see each person for who they are, and the people feel that they are seen by me and valued by me for what they bring to the table. And at the same time, we are all together supporting one another, stepping into a future that seems tangible for all of us. That's what the best team leaders seem to be able to do. They do it by paying attention to individuals, but then also by understanding what they themselves bring to the table and how where they are at their most powerful.
Do you worry that as a society, in schools, at workplaces, we're moving in exactly the opposite direction you're talking about?
I worry that we have a habit of trying to codify things and trying to make our lists, if you like, to go back to the leadership example. And by the very nature of that, what you're doing is making a list of the average performance, if you like, in a role. Because as soon as you start looking at excellence, you find it's different all over the map. So whenever we run into a competency model, they're called at work, or sometimes rubrics in our school, you get a rubric to write an essay. What we're actually codifying is adequate performance. And if we then hitch all of our systems to that, what we're systematizing is adequate average performance. And I think that's something we should be very concerned about.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been great to be here. Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Ashley Goodall, co-author of the new book, 9 Lies About Work, A Freethinking Leader's Guide to the Real World. That comes out today. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin production of the Broadway hit Miss Saigon has ignited discussions on how Asians and Asian Americans are portrayed on stage and on big and small screens. We'll dig into that story coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. In 2 years, Wisconsin could be heading into the next budget cycle with about a $2 billion shortfall. We'll look at that projection and what it means coming up. First, a 6-day run of the Broadway hit musical Miss Saigon opens tonight at the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison. The story, based on the Puccini opera Madame Butterfly, has been updated to be set during the Vietnam War. In the story, a Vietnamese teenager who is orphaned in the conflict is working as a bar girl and has a relationship with an American GI. He's sent back to the States. She gives birth to their child and tries for years to find him. He marries another woman back home, but eventually finds his way back to Vietnam with tragic results. The play has been the focus of controversy since its debut in 1989 because of depictions of Asians and Asian Americans. That controversy has continued in Madison, especially after the cancellation of a panel discussion about the musical. We'll be talking to scholars Tim Yu and Lori Quito Lopez in just a bit about their concerns. Earlier today, I talked to Sandra Gajic, who's the president and CEO of the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison. I asked her if the Overture Center was aware of the protests and well-publicized concerns surrounding Miss Saigon since it was first staged.
There was some, there was definitely awareness that has been most recently, I think, the case. Producers have made deliberate efforts in changing the production since 1989, as you mentioned it.
When there's a controversy or an issue that people are concerned about in a play, I'm thinking of something like Merchant of Venice. Sometimes you'll see a production company address issues of anti-Semitism. Do you feel like for a production company or a venue, there's a need to put some of that in context?
Yes, and I believe that's why exactly why the producers have made these deliberate changes, listening to what the concerns and I believe genuine concerns were surrounding the original production.
What kind of changes? I've never seen any version of Miss Saigon. What kind of changes have been made over the years?
Yeah, to start with is the casting. I know that there were significant concerns and I personally believe justifiable that the cast was not really Asian for the Asian characters. So the leads we have now, Vietnamese American characters, the key role of an Asian character of an engineer was originally cast by a Caucasian person, white person. Then the Vietnamese was not used in any of the lyrics, and so when appropriate, that got changed. I believe these are just some of the changes that have been made, plus some of the set treatment, and so they did redesign some of it. But I know the key changes were really how the casting is addressed and the language.
Now, you had scheduled a panel at the Overture that was to be held last week titled Asian American Perspectives on Miss Saigon, Stereotypes,
Correct.
History, and Community. That was canceled fairly close to the event. Why was that?
Correct. It was, we are attempting to reschedule, not cancel. And so we are hoping that the conversation will still happen just at a later time. Why? I believe that it was a mistake. You know, we overreacted internally here at the Overture to some of our own concerns. And so I called and I apologized to the panelists and all the others that were involved, including Timothy Yu. So the intent was never to discredit their work and their expertise. Hope that we will reconvene at a later point in time. We have some dates in mind, and we hope that we can continue with the dialogue. It might become a broader dialogue than just Miss Saigon, and we are hoping for that.
Looking forward, after Miss Saigon, this current run is done, what are you hoping comes out of this in terms of your relationship to communities around Madison?
Our commitment to equity and innovative ways to apply equity to our programming is constant. Board, staff, we are committed to the programming through the lens of equity. We have a community advisory board, the 24 members from the very diverse community, and I talked to some of the also people involved in this panel we are trying to reschedule. We need some more representation from the Asian American community, so we hope that will be one of the outcomes. And community advisory board has really been an extremely valuable body here at the Overture, helping us really change the way how we see programming. We've done huge strides over the last few years. So that they helped us develop evaluation tool from the equity and diversity perspective. That's really it's a equity criteria that for us is a way how we can evaluate our programming.
Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Me too. Thank you very much and look forward to further conversations.
That's Sandra Gajic, President and CEO of the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison. Now we turn to two members of that panel discussion that was canceled by the Overture Center. Lori Quito-Lopez is an Associate Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. Lori, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Timothy Yu is a Professor of English and Asian American Studies at UW-Madison. Tim, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
Let's start with, you wrote a piece, What's Wrong with Miss Saigon, when this was on its way to Madison. What is wrong, as you see it, with this musical?
Well, actually, I think I will defer to Lori in talking about that, because this is actually Lori's area of expertise.
Okay, Lori?
Yeah, so I study representation of Asian Americans, and I think you can hear a lot of the problems in just the description of the plot, where it's talking about this the Vietnamese prostitute who is trafficked into this relationship, and then turning that into a love story is something that makes a lot of Vietnamese refugees who have experienced trauma during the war very uncomfortable to see. And it upholds a lot of stereotypes that have been really problematic for Asian American women, that they are hypersexualized and just seen as these sexual objects. And the representations of Asian men are also very villainous and negative. So this is in addition to the casting controversies and some of the other problems that have been happening with historical productions.
What would you like to see? Would you like to see maybe another selection to be made, a different play, a different musical? Or if this is being performed, what kind of context would you like to see?
Yeah, so I think the issue of context is really important, because if someone wants to see this play, I think it's really important for them to understand how Asians have been represented and misrepresented and left out of their own stories historically in the U.S., and to think about what that means as they're watching it. And then I also think that we should honor the stories that have been told by Asian American playwrights and other Asian American performing artists and showcase those kinds of stories. So I also think that different choices could be made about what to program and whose voices we should be highlighting.
And Tim, you had written that piece as a part of an effort to provide that context. Can you talk a little bit about the saga of the thing that you wrote, hoping that would be in the material that the audience would have?
Yes, that's right. So a group of us had initially met with Overture back in February to talk about exactly providing this kind of context for audiences. We really wanted to educate audiences about the way Asian Americans have reacted to Miss Saigon. So Overture suggested that I could write a note for the program that they would put in the program. I did write that note. I gave it to them. And then subsequently, they told me that they could not run it due to their contractual obligations with the production company. What we were told later, actually, was that Overture was willing to run the note, but that the production company had rejected it for publication.
And the changes we heard about in the musical, you don't see those as addressing those fundamental issues you'd brought up, Laurie?
Right. So I think one of the fundamental issues that hasn't been brought into the conversation is that this is a play that was written by white men. And so I think the authorship issue is one that we can't change with these kind of superficial modifications to the language in the songs. Or I think the casting issue was very significant, and it's important that that change. But at the end of the day, the core of the story and whose story it is and the ideologies that it perpetuates are the problem.
Let's put this in the wider picture of portrayal of Asians and Asian Americans in American popular culture. What do you see beyond Miss Saigon?
Yeah, this is very systematic of symbolizes a much larger issue. So we see this in all forms of media, movies and TV shows and digital media. And so plays are just one form of this. But Asian Americans are very underrepresented. So for Asian American actors who are looking to break into this industry, they face so much discrimination and racism. They struggle to get these parts. And then when they do, they're stereotypical and they don't have a voice and there's nothing they can do to change it. So this is just one of those kinds of jobs that an Asian American actor might be lucky enough to get. But of course, it has those problems that come with it.
Tim, what are you hoping for? The run is happening. There's a second date now for the initially canceled meeting. What are you hoping happens now going forward?
Well, I really think that what we'd like to see from Overture is a public commitment to make some of these changes. So, for example, can Overture make different kinds of choices in its programming? Can we put a really great Asian American show on the Overture stage? Can we say next time Miss Saigon is offered to Overture that Overture can say, no, maybe that isn't the kind of show that we want for our community? As far as the conversation goes, I think that, so after the panel was canceled, actually what we did was we had a teach-in on the sidewalk outside Overture. So we actually went and said what we would have said at the panel outside the doors of Overture. And I think what that showed was that this conversation is going on with or without the Overture Center. It's something that can go on in other kinds of spaces, and the public is asking these kinds of questions. So I think that conversation is going to continue, and hopefully what it will do is make what we see on stages in Madison and in other communities more responsive to Asian American concerns.
I'll throw a question to both of you, and it's not fair because there's probably not enough time to cover the breadth of it, but can you point us toward great Asian American playwrights that you'd like to see represented at places like the Overture Center or other people you'd look to in popular culture that you might point the audience to?
Well, yes, a great show that I just saw recently is a play called Viet Gone by Quy Nguyen. Nguyen's work is a kind of, it's a play and a musical to some degree based on Vietnamese stories from a refugee camp. And it's about kind of his own stories and his own parents. So that was really a kind of great example of a work that that I thought really brought this story forward.
And Laurie, anything you'd point us toward?
I'll just stick with Tim's suggestion.
Second? Okay, great. So do you see signs of improvement, not getting away from Wisconsin now, but in wider popular culture? Are we getting access to more and more diverse stories about Asians and Asian Americans in American popular culture?
Yeah, the irony of this is that Asian Americans have actually been making great strides forward in broader popular culture. We had this last summer, there were quite a few movies starring Asian Americans that were also produced by Asian Americans. We're seeing television shows that are starring Asian American families. We're seeing novels being written by Asian Americans that are really making it into the mainstream. So actually, this is a moment when Asian Americans are really gaining popularity and hearing their voices in so many different ways. So that's why it's kind of disturbing to have to go back to this issue in theater over and over again.
Right. And I hear that with issues of representation a lot. If all the representation of a group is in two plays or musicals, that puts a lot of weight on those and what happens in those.
Yeah, this is what we call the burden of representation, which is that if you have so few images of a certain group, a minority group, then it matters a lot what those images are. So that's why we care if they're stereotypical, and that's why we care because people are harmed by those images.
And Tim, we're just about out of time. Any thoughts for there might be people out there with different theater companies or other cultural groups around the state? Any thoughts for them as they think ahead on their future calendars?
Well, I think don't be afraid of these conversations. You know, welcome them, embrace them. I think the kind of conversation that we're having right now is exactly the kind of conversation we were trying to have and that we need. Think about different kinds of programming to put on. Look for Asian American voices, Asian American authors, Asian American perspectives, and do what you can to put that on your stage. I think it's pretty simple.
We'll leave it there for now. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Laurie, thanks for coming up.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Laurie Quito-Lopez, Associate Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, and Timothy Yu, Professor of English and Asian American Studies at UW-Madison. They join us to talk about a controversy surrounding representation of people of Asian descent in plays like Miss Saigon. Earlier, we heard from the president and CEO of the Overture Center for the Arts, which is putting on Miss Saigon, Asandra Gajic. Coming up, we'll look at a new projection that shows Wisconsin facing a potential $2 billion budget deficit 2 years from now. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a conservative journalist recently traveled across the country trying to answer the question, what keeps some communities going strong while others decline? He'll tell us what he found out coming up next. Now, a new report shows that if Governor Evers' proposed budget is approved as is, Wisconsin's finances could be heading into the red in a couple years. The analysis from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau says the state would face a $1.9 billion shortfall heading into the next budget cycle. That would be the two-year span starting later in 2021. In addition to assuming Evers gets everything he wants in his current proposal, the forecast makes other assumptions that may or may not come to be. So what should we take away from this projection? Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter with the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Fiscal Bureau comes out with these estimates coming into budget seasons. They try to look into the future. Explain a little bit about what this analysis comes from.
So this analysis is done by the state's nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which just makes analyses of the budget. They do these periodically throughout the budget process every 2 years. And so this is one of the first that they've produced after the governor introduced his budget back in February. This is looking at what his budget would do long term, so ending in the year 2023. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau will make another projection after the Joint Finance Committee produces its budget later in the summer, and he'll do it periodically after that as well, once the final budget is passed, just so lawmakers can have an idea of the long-term fiscal impact. Lawmakers use these types of analyses for looking ahead so that they understand what type of funding we're looking at, what type of revenue we're looking at, given that nothing really changes.
Now, there are a lot of ifs that go into this just shy of $2 billion number. Can you spell out some of those ifs and assumptions for us?
Yeah, so what this analysis is looking at, it provides for only commitments under current law, so everything that is in place right now, plus the provisions that Governor Evers is proposing in his new budget. And what it's not doing is it's not making any assumptions on any population growth, any economic growth, new enrollments, employee compensation, caseloads, or inflation. So it's a pretty conservative in its outlook. It's just saying, you know, if you were to extend the budget, Governor Evers' proposed budget, I should say, and just extended it into the future with the current conditions in place, you would see a $2 billion budget hole that you would have to fill once you hit the beginning of the 2021-23 budget cycle.
And how does this projected shortfall stack up against previous estimates at this stage of the game?
So it's pretty high. We're coming out of a budget season right now, the current one, which saw an $865 million shortfall. This one is $2 billion that we'd be experiencing. This is the highest we've seen since the 2011-13 biennium, which that projection was made when Governor Doyle was still in office. So this is higher than any of the shortfalls under Governor Walker.
And what's been the response from Republican leadership to this estimate?
Republicans, unsurprisingly, have been pretty upset about it. They say that the $2 billion structural deficit is unacceptable, given that the state is working with, I think it's around $2 billion in additional funding going into the next cycle. So they're saying, you know, because of growth in revenue in the state, you know, you should be able to work. This is saying to the governor, you should be able to work with additional funding that's already provided, but this goes far beyond that.
Have we had any reaction from Governor Evers to this report yet?
Not in my reporting. I'm not able to speak to that at this point.
Now, this the big if here, of course, is if the Governor Evers budget was approved line by line by the Republican legislature. The odds on that are very slim, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, that's very unlikely to happen. But of course, in politics, anything is possible. So we'll see.
Now, what is next? What are you watching for with the budget process now with this report in hand?
So the Joint Finance Committee is starting hearings this week. They will be asking agency heads about some of the different provisions in the governor's budget, asking them to defend the funding that they're asking for. After that, there still need to be conversations between lawmakers and the governor. Speaker Voss has said that Republicans will produce a budget on time by June 30th, but this is likely to go a lot farther into the future, because as we've seen so far, there isn't a whole lot of agreement between Republicans and Democrats as to what they should include in the budget.
Often the governor's budget is the starting point. It's the blueprint that lawmakers use. Republicans have been talking about scrapping the governor's proposal and starting from scratch. Is that right?
That still seems to be the case. It's a very process-heavy few months we're looking at, but it does seem that they're still planning to essentially start from the base budget, yes.
And you mentioned that budget deadline, which looms, but it's not like the federal budget deadline, right, where there's not going to be a Wisconsin government shutdown. If they don't pass a budget, we just keep on rolling with the current budget as it was.
Yep, that's exactly right. The budgets can stretch into the fall. I think the last budget that passed passed eventually in September of 2017, if I'm correct. So it's certainly typical for it to go past June 30th. Yes, funding goes back to, or just funding is sustained at the base levels.
And so far, as you're looking at it, it looks like this is going to be more of an adversarial process between the Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers than a cooperative process. Is that a fair assessment at this point?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I mean, there's just not a lot of agreement at this point, even from where to begin building the budget. Governor Evers, for instance, wants to take hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money to to expand Medicaid in the state, and Republicans, both on principle and they've been citing several studies showing that the cost sharing there will be a significant cost shift involved in expanding Medicaid in the state that would be a detriment to the market. And so that's one of the big parts of Governor Evers' budget that is already a no-go for Republicans. I mean, beyond that, there are a ton of policies that Republicans are extremely against just on principle.
And we'll jump in. Thanks for joining us today. That was Riley Vedderkin with the Wisconsin State Journal looking at the latest on the state budget. It's warming up gradually in Wisconsin, and while there's a lot to like about winter, I'm sure I'm not the only person looking forward to spring, summer, and fall. But with the nicer weather comes the downside. We all know it's coming. The mosquitoes will return. Some new research might help us out. In this week's edition, last week's edition of the journal Acta Tropica, researchers published a study showing that a particular type of sound could interrupt the breeding and feeding cycle for mosquitoes. That sound was a track by the producer and musician Skrillex. Apparently, when his song Scary Monsters and Nice Sprites was played at a particular kind of mosquito, it cut down on mosquito bites. Now, female mosquitoes want blood after, let's say, they do things to make baby mosquitoes. When they heard this track from Skrillex, they were less likely to do those things and less interested in gathering blood. There's a serious side to this research. Scientists aren't just blaring club music at insects for fun. This particular type of mosquito can carry dengue fever, so the hope is to develop some kind of sonic mosquito prevention tool. Closer to home, would this help prevent mosquito bites for us in Wisconsin? Here's how to test it out. Go out for a quiet camping weekend this summer in a remote scenic landscape, gather around the campfire, and blare this through your speakers. And don't blame me when the wardens come and arrest you. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.